I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The ability to influence quickly in a matter of seconds is something that few have. And unfortunately, just as many who can dismantle a conflict or seal a deal, if not more so, can also kill, steal, and cheat. It is mind control at its most effective, black belt mind control, as it were, that the sociology, neuroscience, and colorful anecdotes along the way are found in a fascinating new book, Split Second Persuasion, The Ancient Art and New Science of Changing Minds. Its author, Dr. Kevin Dutton, joins me now from Toronto. He is a leading expert on the science of social influence. He teaches at Cambridge, where he is a research fellow at the Faraday Institute of Science and Religion at St. Edmund's College and at the University of Western Australia in Perth. Split Second Persuasion is published by Doubleday. The website for more is at flipgnosis.co.uk. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Dr. Kevin Dutton. Good morning, Professor Dutton.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very well, yourself?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
This is a great book, and as I said, I'm about halfway through it. And I'm reading it, and it feels like I'm sitting in one of your classes and you're just talking to us, imparting this heavy science in a sort of accessible way. Was that the point of how you put this book together?
Yeah, it was actually, Joe. You know, when I first started to write the book, what I rather ambitiously and grandiosely planned was, you know what we're like in bookshops. You go into a bookshop and you pick a book off the shelves and you kind of leaf around and you have a little poke through it, and most times you put the book back on the shelf and move on to another one. What I wanted to do was I wanted to see if on every page I could put something that hooked the person in the bookshop who was just leafing through it, to kind of, no matter what page they were on, they turned to at random, excited them or gave them something to think about. And I always intended the book to entertain as well as educate. And I'm really so happy that you see it that way. That's exactly how I planned it.
And it's also very funny. That's the other thing I noticed. So if we read the book, will we be more persuasive?
Yeah, we certainly will. A lot of people have asked me, you know, whether anybody can learn to be a split-second persuader. And I've got to be honest up front. The answer to that question is probably not. Persuasion is a talent. Like anything else, it's like an athletic talent, for instance. Not everybody is going to be able to run 100 meters in under 10 seconds, say. Not everyone is going to stand on the Olympic 100-meter start line and compete for Canada. In the same vein, not everybody is going to be an elite persuader. There are always going to be some people, Joe, who are going to be better at it than others. They're going to have more natural talent. But what we can do, exactly like training for an athletics event, is we can get better than we are. We can improve our performance as a persuader from the baseline that we might start at. And so that is something which people can certainly do by buying the book.
And it can also teach us how to be wary of chronic persuaders, right?
You got it. That's very, very important. That's absolutely true. I mean, if you want to be a better persuader, one of the things that you need is knowledge. You need to know the tricks of the trade. But you also need to be able to go out there and practice it. You know, one of the keys to being a better persuader, just like anything, is to go out and persuade. It's to go out and do it, right? But when you learn how to be a better persuader and you know the tricks of the trade, you also know what to look for when you encounter it yourself, when someone's trying to persuade you. So it's a double whammy in many senses. You know, if you can make yourself a better persuader, but you can also kind of inoculate yourself, I suppose, against people trying to persuade you. You'll know the telltale signs of what to look for.
So we all need spice in our life, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, the spice model is what I call the DNA of persuasion. I'll just unpack that for you a little bit. I mean, when I first got round to writing the book, what I wanted to do was I wanted to uncover the core ingredients of persuasion. And it started off a few years ago when I was at a conference in San Francisco, and I was there for about a week, and made the big mistake of not booking a hotel until I got there, because I was pushed for time, and I flipped open the yellow pages and I booked a really cheap hotel. And of course there was a reason why it was cheap, because it was a pretty grungy kind of establishment, and all the down and outs and the homeless seemed to congregate outside the hotel. And actually, to be perfectly honest with you, Joe, you know, having been inside it, I think they were in a better place. It was pretty grungy, but anyway, after a week of kind of coming in and out and seeing these guys, I was on first name terms with them. I was giving them cash, and you know, in the end, they had more money than I did. And I thought, I can't give them any more. And then on the last day, a new guy had joined their ranks. Now, they all had their cardboard placards and bits of cardboard, hungry and homeless, Vietnam vet, 6 months to live, and all that. But then this new guy joined on the last day, and he held up a placard, and it said, "Why lie? I want beer." And that guy couldn't have got the money out of me any faster had he pulled a gun out of his pocket and pointed it at me. I just, ka-ching, gave him the money there and then. Now, that's all. That, you know, "Why lie, I want beer," that has become pretty, you know, pretty popular now. You see that kind of slogan around quite a bit. But in those days, back 5 years ago, you know, it was the first time I'd kind of seen this. In fact, I saw an even better one earlier in the year in Sydney, Australia. There was a homeless guy leaning against a brick wall, and he had a placard, and it said on it, "Schizophrenic, been on the road 6 months, both of us." And I thought that was really cool. Again, ka-ching, put the money in his hat. But what that got me thinking was, you know, as an academic, I was used to persuasion being framed in a kind of due process and negotiation way of trial and error, of it happening over time. But clearly, I realized there was a kind of a militant strain of persuasion, which worked very, very quickly and bypassed the usual routes. And so what I did was I collected quite a few examples of this, and I analyzed it for the key factors. And what came up were these five factors which comprise the SPICE model. And they stand, the SPICE model stands for simplicity, perceived self-interest, incongruity, confidence, and empathy. And that is kind of what I call the DNA of persuasion.
Self-interest. Let's move to that one, because I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
That, as much as being influenced by someone, being told to do something, you think about how that'll affect you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely right. You know, when I was writing Flipgnosis, Joe, I spent some time with some of the world's top con artists. And I was, you know, keen to discover, actually, first of all, whether the kind of tricks of the trade that these guys had kind of worked out from first principles actually matched the kind of stuff I'd learned as an academic, you know, in the books and the labs. And there was a pretty good match between the two. But one of the questions that I asked these guys when I was with them was, you know, what is there a single most important factor in getting someone to do what you want? And virtually to a man, they all said that one of the most important things in persuasion is self-interest. You know, 99% of people make the same kind of fundamental mistake when it comes to thinking about persuasion. 99% of people think that the fundamental goal of persuasion is to get someone to do something for you. Actually, the fundamental goal of persuasion, Joe, is to get someone to do something for themselves. Okay? If you can frame your message so it's in the self-interest of the person who you're trying to persuade, rather than it appearing in your own interest, you're going to have a much better chance of pulling it off than if it was the other way around. And one of the examples I give here is, it was a really nice example of, I was at a New Year's Eve party once, and a friend of mine's seven-year-old son wanted to stay up and see the New Year in with the rest of us until after 12, and his mum just wouldn't have it. She wouldn't let him do it. And she turned around to him and she said, "Look, you know how cranky you get when you stay up late. You know, you get very irritable the next day. You don't get up until, you know, midday. And without missing a beat, the seven-year-old turned round to his mum and he said, "Well, you don't want me up at the crack of dawn while you're lying in bed with a hangover, do you?" Right? Now, that is an absolutely quintessential example, Joe, from a seven-year-old, mate, of how to deploy the principle of self-interest to get what you want. And it worked. He was allowed to stay up. We all laughed. Also very important, you know, a bit of humor and persuasion, very important. And he got his message across. And, of course, there was a lot of truth in it, too.
So something that I'm not a scientist, so I don't know much about the brain. And apparently the brain has developed over time, has it?
It has, yeah. Oh, yeah. The brain has evolved over millions of years of time, yeah.
Yeah, and so the ability to change the minds of others, or have our minds change, as it were, has that evolved too?
Yeah, I think one of the things which people often say to me is, I've never been a great persuader. I can't persuade people to do anything. And one of the things which I always say to them is, actually, there was a time when we were all among the greatest persuaders on earth. And of course, that time was when we first came into the world, when we were newborns. Now, I mean, think about it. The persuasion mountain that we faced on our very first day on the planet was immense. We had to persuade those people around us to look after us, to take care of us, to subjugate their own interests at the expense of ours. And of course, we managed it without language, without consciousness, without any of the oratorical tricks of the trade that we have today as adults. And how did we do that? Well, natural selection equipped us with two features fitted a standard, fiendishly calibrated to cut right through the kind of ozone layer of consciousness that we have as adults and go right through to the emotion centers of our brains. And those two features were a pretty much unignorable soundtrack, that piercing cry that features amongst nearly everyone's list of aversive acoustic stimuli, and appallingly cute good looks, which prove almost irresistible to anyone that encounters them. So before we became linguistically able, before we developed the ability to speak, we had an extreme talent to get other people to do what we want, to wind them round our little finger. And if you go even further back into evolution, even before, you know, we humans evolved, influence in the animal kingdom might not be as sophisticated as it is today, but it sure as hell is much quicker. Influence travels in fast straight lines in the animal kingdom. You look at courtship rituals, you look at submission postures, you look at threat displays. There's absolutely no doubt that these things work very quickly and effectively. And kind of with the evolution of language and higher order brain function, we kind of lost that expediency a little bit.
And the other thing that I found interesting in the book and disturbing or disappointing for me was that good-looking people have an advantage, don't they?
It's very sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very, very sad. It's true. They do. Good looks are something known in psychology as the halo effect, okay? And the halo effect refers to the fact that just because we perceive one, I suppose in inverted commas, good, attractive quality in someone, we kind of think that they are in possession of other kind of attractive or good qualities, truth, wisdom, that kind of thing being one. It's a logical fallacy, of course, but good looks have been shown to work across all sorts of persuasion arenas. Good-looking criminals get more lenient sentences from juries. Studies have shown that. With the possible exception of fraud, where it might actually go the other way. But good-looking people manning charity stands get more signatories on their petitions than average-looking people. So I'm afraid, yeah, it's one of those things that we can't really do anything about. But, of course, now we know, you know, when you're faced with that kind of situation, you might think twice.
Yeah. You're good in this book in talking about the traits of those who are successful at persuading criminals and you know, people that aren't criminals. What's common amongst those who, for lack of a better word, are losers in influence, who never get their way, who are always trod on in life?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think one of the main things where people kind of go wrong, I suppose, in persuasion is kind of with the empathy factor of the Spice model. And we all know that you know, there are people out there, and these guys are always going to be you know, more naturally talented, better persuaders than others. But we can all learn to do better on that particular dimension. And it's in particular, the ability to just tune in and transmit your message on another person's wavelength rather than your own. And, you know, often it's very, very simple differences that really tip the balance. I'll give you a good example, one which I often give. Imagine I was your boss, and imagine that I wanted you to put in an extra 2 hours at the end of the day to work on a presentation that had to be ready for the morning. Imagine I just said to you, hey, Joe, do you mind putting in another couple of hours, you know, because we really need this presentation? My chances might be 50-50.
Right.
But on the other hand, imagine that I knew, let's say that you were into, I don't know, marathon running, you'd run the Toronto Marathon or the New York Marathon or whatever, and you were a keen endurance athlete. If I subtly rephrased that and I said to you, hey, Joe, do you think you've got the stamina to put in another couple of hours? Okay? That word, just that subtle rephrasing, stamina, taps in to something that really matters to you. You're part of your self-concept. And I'm much more likely to get a result that way than if I just blandly sort of ask you a request, or, you know, just spell it out generically. So one of the things which I think really goes wrong in persuasion is we don't really take the time to frame our messages in the right way, to I guess do our homework a little bit and find out the kind of things that really matter to people and the kind of things that people you know, might be more willing to listen to.
Naturally, one wonders who are the great influencers that we encounter day to day, and I'm just thinking in the realm of public life, but celebrities, politicians. Who are some that come to mind for you?
In this day and age,
yeah.
I think that I certainly think that I mean, I guess it's a bit of a cliched argument, but I certainly think that that Barack Obama is certainly a great orator. He's having a bit of a hard time at the moment in the States, but I think Obama for me stands out as a great communicator. He's got an uphill battle at the moment, but certainly in terms of the way he interacts with an audience and with the general public, I think he's probably, I think he's certainly got something going for him. I think also, you know, if we're just talking about persuasion ability, I think Tony Blair, another politician in the UK, whether you agree with his policies or not, was another guy who was very, very good, very slick, very good at persuading people to listen to his message and to get his message across. So I think there's a couple of guys from politics who kind of stand out in terms of being, I suppose, persuasion ambassadors. Whether you agree with their policies or not is kind of, you know, a kind of a side issue. But, you know, the ability to actually get people to listen to them and to implement policies, I think those two stand out for me in recent years.
The idea of groups and
sure,
being part of a group, I find it fascinating. Does being part of a group, say, if their views are different than ours,
yeah,
does it, say, make us more tolerant of their views?
Well, yeah. That's a very interesting question. I think, yeah, I mean, one of the ways in which we've evolved, I mean, when we were our prehistoric ancestors, when they were on the East African savannah, say, you know, millions of years ago, successful life was very much a group life. And being part of a group was really our very first insurance policy. If you became ostracized or separated from the group, Joe, you know, you would become at risk of being killed by predators, etc., etc. So our brains are hardwired to conform, to be up for group membership. And there are ways in which you can take advantage of that ancient wiring system to get people to do what you want. And there's a great study which was conducted by an American psychologist called Bob Cialdini a couple of years ago, in which he wanted to get people, we've all been in that situation where we've been in hotel rooms, where, you know, you get that message on the wall, you know, will you please recycle your towels, because it helps the environment and, you know, blah, blah, blah. What Cialdini wanted to know was what was the most effective kind of message to put in a hotel room to get people to do that. And so he experimented with a load of hotel rooms and a load of different messages. One kind of message said, please help the hotel to save money. Another kind of message said, please partner with the hotel to make the environment a greener place. And another group, there was three or four of these messages, and another message said, very simply, something like 75, I can't remember the exact figure now, 75% of people that stayed in this hotel recycled their towels, the normative influence option. And lo and behold, what he found was that the normative influence option, the people that stayed in the room with that message in, were far more likely to recycle their towels than guests in any of the other rooms. And here's the deal, Joe. When he further nuanced that message to read 75% or whatever it was of people who stayed in this room, not just this hotel, in this room recycled their towels, acquiescence shot up even higher. So what you're doing there, you're tapping into that ancient evolutionary drive to be part of a group, to stick to norms. And by doing that, you're really getting your message across and getting a result far more effectively than any of the other kind of ways of influencing people. So, you know, appealing to that desire to be part of a group, very, very powerful.
Well, Professor Dunn, I could talk all day with you. This is a fascinating book. Congratulations on the continued good luck with it.
Well, many, many thanks, and thanks for having me on the show, mate.
You're very welcome. The book is called Split Second Persuasion, The Ancient Art and New Science of Changing Minds. It's published by Doubleday. The website for more, flipgnosis.co.uk. Its author, Dr. Kevin Dutton, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.